We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
You don't want it. You don't need it. But you're going to get it anyway. The Kevin Sheehan Show. Here's Kevin.
On the show today, Scott Van Pelt will join us from Southern Hills in Tulsa, Oklahoma. That's the site of this year's PGA Championship. Tiger Woods is there. Phil Mickelson is not there. I will ask him about both of those individuals, and we'll get his picks and even maybe a sleeper pick or two. I know he wants to talk also about the Caps going out in six to the Panthers. I know he was disappointed about that. I have some Washington Commanders stuff for everybody to think about coming up here in a moment. But I wanted to start with how much I enjoyed watching the Miami Heat last night in the second half against Boston. Boston came into this game one of the Eastern Conference Finals limited. They were without Marcus Smart. They were without Al Horford last night. Horford was in health protocols, and Smart is battling a foot sprain. And, you know, they had the emotional weekend with the Game 6 win and then the 7th and deciding win game on Sunday in Boston, where they blew out the defending champion Bucks to advance to the Eastern Conference Finals. And Miami's had more time and more rest waiting. But they were down, the Heat were, at halftime by 8, 62-54. Tatum had 21 in the first half and was sensational. And then came the third quarter. Jimmy Butler's been one of my favorite players in the NBA for a while. I've mentioned before that I think Kawhi Leonard is not only my favorite player in the NBA, he is one of my favorite players right now in all sports. Now, he's been hurt for over a year, clearly the Clippers missed him. They didn't make the playoffs. They were in the play-in, and then they lost Paul George, so they didn't even make the final eight. I would expect if Paul George and Kawhi Leonard are healthy next year and back, that the Clippers will be a threat in the West. But Butler, to me, is also one of these incredible two-way players, and sometimes is kind of underrated because of his style, and maybe sometimes because of the lack of aggressiveness offensively. But he led a Miami Heat defensive effort at the beginning of the third quarter that was just incredible to watch. It was suffocating. Boston could not get close to scoring. They had put up 62 in the first half, and they didn't make their first shot from the field in the third quarter until 4 minutes and 53 seconds remained in the quarter. At that point, they were already down double digits, and they went from an 8-point halftime lead to a 17-point end of third quarter deficit, being outscored 39-14. 39 points is a lot of points to score in a quarter. But make no mistake, if you were watching this, this was all about Miami's defense and the incredible aggressiveness and physicality that was taken up multiple notches to enter that third quarter. And it was really fun to watch. Jimmy Butler went for 41 in the game, but his defense is what led. Bam had 4 blocked shots. There were 20 blocked shots in the game last night, 12 by Miami, 3 by Jimmy Butler. Butler had three block shots to go with, you know, an incredible overall performance. As I mentioned, 41 points in the game for Butler, including 17 in the third quarter of that game. But Butler also added an incredible overall box score. Butler finished with the 41 points, had three block shots, as I mentioned, four steals, nine rebounds, and five assists. He was great. He was unbelievable in the game last night. Love watching him play. Now, that third quarter was epic. The Celtics were 2-for-15 from the field. It was their worst shooting quarter over the last four seasons, playoffs and regular season. Also, I mentioned that it took Boston 7 minutes and 7 seconds to score in the third quarter from the field. The last time it took Boston that long to score in a quarter was back in 2002. And something got mentioned during the course of the game, and I went to look it up after the game, and I was amazed at what I found. The last time it took Boston 7+ minutes to score in a quarter was Game 3 of the 2002 Eastern Conference Semifinals against Detroit, a game in which the final score was 66-64. In a playoff game in the NBA, the final score of the game was 66-64, Boston over Detroit. I did a double take when I heard it. I still didn't believe it until I went to basketballreference.com. I pulled up the game box score. These were the Celtics of Paul Pierce, Antoine Walker, Kenny Anderson, etc. It was the Pistons of Stackhouse and Cliff Robinson and Ben Wallace before they had their championship nucleus with Rasheed Wallace and with Chauncey Billups. 66-64, a game in which the Pistons shot 34.8% from the field. The Celtics shot 34.6% from the field. And the two teams combined to go 4-for-39 from behind the arc. 4-for-39. The score at halftime was Boston 37, Detroit 33. The score at the end of three quarters of an NBA playoff game was 48-48. I mentioned the other night when Phoenix, I mentioned the other day about Phoenix having just 50 points at the end of the third quarter in Game 7 at home against Dallas. They ended up scoring 40 in the fourth period to end up with 90 overall, but that I just could not remember a team having only 50 points through three quarters. Well, the NBA back in 2002, pre the elimination of the hand check, pre the defensive 3-second rule, I think. It was really the elimination of the hand check that created a more free-flowing game. Remember, the NBA was in trouble. You know, we were now at the point where Jordan was gone. The three-peat of Shaq and Kobe was in the rear view a little bit. And we were into that stretch of San Antonio and the Nets and the Pistons and some ugly, low-scoring basketball. That, you know, teams were being stymied with hand checks and with overly physical play on the perimeter. 66-64. In that series, by the way, which only went five games, Boston won that series in five. Nobody scored 100 points in a game. Nobody did. The most points scored in a game was Detroit scored 96 in game one, but the scores after that were 85-77, 66-64, 90-79, and then 90-81. Basketball was in a tough spot then. I mean, as much of an NBA fan as I have been my entire life, that was a painful stretch of basketball to watch. It really was. You know, I've said many times, and I think we even talked about it yesterday, that really 2004, the Pistons win in the NBA Finals with Chauncey Billups and Rasheed Wallace and Ben Wallace and Tayshaun Prince, Rip Hamilton, etc., that's the last time that a team won the title without an obvious top five player in the league. And it was just a different game there for that stretch of years. Jordan was in the rear view. God, the Showtime Lakers were very much in the rear view. Teams were defending, and they were able to get away with anything until they loosened up the rules and allowed for a more free-flowing game by essentially, more than anything, eliminating the ability to hand-check on the perimeter. Anyway, I love the game last night. I love Jimmy Butler. I still think that Boston, healthy, as long as they are healthy and get back to being full at full strength, I still think they'll win this series. But God, Miami's so fun to watch if you are into really well-coached basketball teams. They have more than just one person involved in their offensive sets. Everybody understands their role offensively. Jimmy Butler is not overly aggressive. He got 41 points last night on 12 of 19 from the field. When I say overly aggressive, he got to the free throw line a ton. But he doesn't, you know, he doesn't hunt his shots. The ball moves offensively, and they're so, so well coached by Eric Spoelstra defensively. They're exceptional defensively. Boston's a very good defensive team as well. Game one tonight between Luka and Steph, Golden State and Dallas. I mentioned yesterday I like Golden State to win the title, but this should be a fascinating series, and how they guard Doncic will be fun to watch. Do you double him? Do you just help off of him? You know, you don't want to leave certain shooters wide open. You got to be careful when you help in this league, even though Dallas doesn't have the greatest necessarily of supporting casts. I would expect personally Klay Thompson, maybe Draymond Green guarding him, and more help defense versus just outright double teams. It's hard to double in the NBA on a guy like Luka consistently. You will end up playing, being at a deficit. It'll be 4-on-3 basketball, and that's death. And usually it's death with a dunk or a wide open look. And then you're just praying that the other team misses. But I bet you that there is consistent every possession help on Luka to try to get him to either shoot contested shots or give the ball up kind of later in the shot clock. We'll see what happens. All right, up next, where the Commanders rank on the latest ESPN Seth Walder Analytics Football Power Index rankings. We'll get to that next, right after these words from a few of our sponsors.
Philip has just lost the respect of the youth league football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
All right, some breaking news, actually, in between recording the first segment and getting ready here to start this second segment. The Eagles have signed James Bradberry to a one-year deal. So Bradberry, the corner in New York last year, drafted by Ron Rivera and the Panthers back in 2016, had a high-quality year, is a high-quality corner. I mentioned this when he became available, that Washington not only should be interested, but they should try to make it work, that he would be the best cornerback on their team. Bradberry signs, according to Schefter, a one-year, $10 million deal, $7.5 million of it guaranteed. So roughly $2.5 million in incentives. The other thing Schefter reported is that James Bradberry initially had 11 teams reach out. His agents whittled it down to three teams, and eventually he chose the Eagles over the others. I have no idea if Washington was one of the final three, but I would bet big money that Washington was one of the 11 to reach out. Washington probably was looking for what Bradberry was going to command. The spot rack projection was like $12 million, so he got a little bit less than that. He got $10 million and really $7.5 million guaranteed, roughly. And Washington was probably looking to see what the market would be like and whether or not they could afford him. Because the bottom line is, once you took on $28.3 million in salary cap hit for next year, in the form of Carson Wentz in that trade, it limited your ability to be more active in free agency. Well, Kevin, what about A.J. Brown and all the money he just got from Philadelphia? Well, his cap number next year in Philadelphia is roughly $5.5 to $6 million. So longer-term deal, able to structure it around the cap. It had some cap flexibility with it. With the Carson Wentz deal, Washington didn't opt to restructure. And now, don't we know more than even before that this Carson Wentz trade really is about a one-year flyer, no matter what they say? Because if they had significant interest in James Bradberry and thought that they really needed to have him, which I think they should have felt, they could have restructured Wentz now and made it work with Bradberry. Maybe they did offer to do that if Bradberry chose Washington. I don't know. And there's still a chance that Washington wasn't interested at all. But I would bet a lot of money that they were one of the 11 teams to reach out and at least express some interest as long as the price got to within their range. Washington didn't restructure Carson Wentz's $28.3 million salary cap next year because it would have then meant they would have taken on more dead cap money in 2023 and 2024 if it doesn't work out with Carson Wentz in 2022. That's why. They're hoping. They don't know for sure. Most of you who are fans of the team, and from my seat as well, there's hope. There's certainly not any sort of guarantee with Carson Wentz. I certainly expect better quarterback play than they've had in recent years. But I am not sure, and I would bet against, as I've said since they traded for him, that Carson Wentz is the long-term answer. I would bet against that. Philadelphia now has a loaded roster. They have done a hell of a job. Offensively, they've got playmakers everywhere. In the backfield, at wide receiver, at tight end. The big question, of course, is at quarterback. Their offensive line is outstanding. On defense, they're going to get Brandon Graham back to go with Fletcher Cox and Derek Barnett and the rookie Jordan Davis. They also drafted N'Kobe Dean at a spot that was considered by most to be high value. They added Hassan Reddick. I think that's an underrated offseason signing. And now their corners are James Bradberry and Darius Slay. If Jalen Hurts is the answer, Philadelphia is a Super Bowl contender in 2022. I believe in Jalen Hurts. I actually like him as a player, and I think they made the playoffs in part because Jalen Hurts' dual threat ability. They ran the ball on everybody, and Jalen Hurts is a very good running quarterback. I think he's more than that, and I think we're going to start to find that out this year. But he did completely S the bed in that playoff game against Tampa Bay. Philadelphia's loaded with draft choices next year as well. This is a team right now that has a chance to win the NFC East and win a bunch of games. And if Hurts really steps it up here in year three, I think Philadelphia is a sleeper NFC Championship contender in 2022. That leads me to this. So I put out, I took a call this morning on the radio show, and it made me think of something, and I just said it out loud, even though I didn't do any research on it necessarily. But I said to somebody at some point this morning, you know, Washington a year ago defensively was supposed to be, you know, incredible. I mean, many people thought top five defense. I saw people predict Washington's defense to be the best in the league next year. And here we are a year later. And I said, you can make the case that Washington's defense on paper anyway, in terms of the talent it has, is dead last in the NFC East. Philadelphia's defense is better. Dallas's defense is better. And the Giants' defense is probably at least the same as Washington's. Washington's strength is still in the defensive front. If Chase Young bounces back and continues the trend, the career trajectory that we thought he was on after year one, if he's healthy too, Montez Sweat, same thing. I don't think we have any concerns about John Allen. Daron Payne is playing in a contract year. He's got to step up and be big. They're going to have to get some help from their second-round pick, Phil Mathis. But Philadelphia's defensively is more talented on all three levels than Washington. So is Dallas. And look, the Giants, first of all, they added Wink Martindale as their defensive coordinator. You know, they got a completely new coaching staff. But don't forget, they've got Leonard Williams and Dexter Lawrence up front. They drafted Kayvon Thibodeau. They've got Martinez and Ojulari, who I think is a star on the rise. You know, Washington has major questions at linebacker, obviously, and questions about their secondary. And so I asked the question on Twitter this morning, and we took calls. This time last year, most fans of this team, most observers and experts commenting on the team, expected the defense to lead the way. It expected a defense that was going to be, you know, top five, maybe elite, you know, maybe the best in the league. I expected it to be improved, but we all had an understanding of the quarterbacks that they would be facing and that there would be, you know, perhaps an improvement, but maybe statistically not what it was in 2020, because there was a major difference in the offenses and the quarterbacks that they were facing on their 2021 schedule versus their 2020 schedule. And this year, you can just make the case very easily that you're more confident in the offense than you are on the defense. And that's the NFL for you, man. When you don't have the answer at quarterback, things change year to year, week to week. Last year, it was the defense that was going to carry them, and hopefully Fitzpatrick would be better than what they've had, and they could win 9 or 10 games and get back to the postseason after making it in 2020. But it was going to be the defense that led the way, and it didn't. And this year, the offense. 63.6% of the people believe that the offense will lead the way this year, not the defense. 36.4% think it's the defense. What a difference a year makes. Last year, defense, defense, defense. This year, offense, offense, offense. No, it's not as loud this year as it was last year. There was a certainty to the conversation about the defense last year that does not exist this year. There are a lot of question marks around Carson Wentz in particular. Reasonable, justifiable concerns about Carson Wentz. He could be better, but will he be good enough? But last year, defense, 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 and people were 100% convinced that this was going to be a very good defense, if not an elite defense, and it wasn't. And this year, as the poll reflects, people are more inclined to lean in the direction of the offense leading the way. So that leads me to this before we get to Scott. So ESPN does its power rankings, which are really voted on and discussed by the beat reporters for each of the 32 teams, like John Keim here in Washington. But Seth Walder, who writes for their analytics group at ESPN, He puts together something that's more predictive based on a lot of different metrics. He calls it his ESPN. It's called the ESPN Football Power Index. And it uses a lot of predictive kind of statistical modeling. No matter how much you believe in that, this is just something that's thought out a little bit more. And it's the first thing that I have found, really, that's out there already post-draft that ranks defenses and offenses for next year. And I was just curious as to what anybody was saying about next year's, you know, teams offensively and defensively, because as we just discussed, there is a belief now that Washington's offense is better than its defense. And I mentioned that I think Washington's defense could be on paper the worst defense in the division right now. I certainly don't think it's as good as Dallas's or Philadelphia's defense. And the Giants' defense, as mentioned, isn't terrible either. And has a new defensive coordinator. So this was the first thing that I found that kind of predicts offensive and defensive rankings for next year. Now, their overall, if you're curious, rankings of the teams, the Football Power Index rankings has the Bills as the best team in the league, the Packers, Rams, Chiefs, Bucks, Cowboys, Chargers, Colts with Matt Ryan, Cardinals, and Browns as the top 10. They've got Washington at 20. Ahead of the Giants by two spots, and behind Philadelphia by two spots. Philadelphia is at 18, the Giants are at 22. If you're wondering if Washington's overall Football Power Index ranking of 20th is good enough to make the playoffs in the weakened NFC, it isn't. They've got Washington as the ninth best NFC team. They've got the Packers, Rams, Bucks, Cowboys, Cardinals, Vikings, Eagles, and Saints ahead of Washington in their overall Football Power Index rankings for next year. Now, as it relates to where their defense is supposed to be, at least based on this, that's what I was looking for. I was looking for something, you know, in terms of what people out there outside of this area are thinking about Washington offensively and defensively this year. Well, Washington defensively, according to Seth Walder's Football Power Index, will have the 26th ranked defense in the league next year. 26th! Now remember, the Football Outsiders DVOA metric of where they ranked last year, 27th. They were 27th last year at the end of the year. They were third the year before in the Football Outsiders DVOA metric. But in this Football Power Index predictive ranking for next year on ESPN, produced by Seth Walder and his team in the analytics department at ESPN, Washington predicted to have the 26th best defense in the NFL next year, tied with the New York Football Giants. The Eagles are ahead of them. The Eagles are projected to have the 23rd ranked defense. Man, I would have thought that it would have been higher. And Dallas projected to have the 6th best defense in the NFL. So there is, you know, somebody outside of our world looking at all 32 teams and saying today on May 18th, and maybe the Eagles will be higher after acquiring Bradberry, that Washington will have the 26th best defense in the NFL this year. What a difference a year makes. If you're wondering offensively, 19th, the 19th best offense in the league. Dallas is predicted to have the 4th best offense in the league. Philadelphia, the 17th best offense in the league. And the Giants, the 23rd best offense in the league. So Washington, third best offense in the division, tied for the worst defense predicted in 2022 in the division. There was something else too that I wanted to look for if I found the, you know, kind of predictions on offensive and defensive rankings for next year. Last year, defensively, with all of the positivity and optimism around its defense, we all really focused in on the fact that they were going to face a, group of quarterbacks that seemed almost unprecedented in terms of a schedule. You know, Washington facing all those great quarterbacks, and by the way, not just great quarterbacks, highly skilled offensive teams. And if everybody stayed healthy for the most part, it was going to be murderer's row. And we acknowledged that while the defense was going to be great, or we thought it was going to be really, really good, you know, they had a challenge last year. So this year, if we flip it around and say we're more optimistic about the offense, well, what will the offense be facing in terms of defenses on their schedule? Is it possible that the defenses that the offense, the improved offense is going to face are just so good that maybe we won't see the results? Or is it so bad that it should absolutely thrive next year? So based on this ESPN Football Power Index and the rankings that, you know, drove the overall team rankings, offense and defense, et cetera, I wanted to look at what they were predicting Washington's schedule to be next year defensively. And the results are kind of mixed. You know, they face the best defense they face based on, again, Seth Walter's predictions for next year is Indianapolis's defense, predicted to be the third best defense in the NFL. That's followed by two games against Dallas, predicted to have the sixth best defense in the NFL. They'll also face Green Bay, the 10th best defense in the NFL based on these predictions. Tennessee, the 11th best defense in the NFL based on these predictions. And believe it or not, Atlanta, who is predicted to have the 16th best defense in the NFL. So that would be five of their 17 games against defenses predicted to be in the top half of the league. Indy, again, two against Dallas, Green Bay, Tennessee, and Atlanta. Every other game, okay, the other 11 are against defenses in the back half of the league based on this prediction. San Francisco's defense is supposed to be, for whatever reason, much worse this year. 17th best. That's followed by some teams that really start to get into the lower end of the league in terms of predicted defensive rankings next year. Philadelphia, two games against them at 23. Then you go, following that, the Giants at 26. We've already talked about they're tied with Washington for 26th. You get two games against them. Then you've got Jacksonville, predicted to be a terrible defense, at 28th. Then at 30th, the Bears, and then at 31st, Detroit, and 32nd, Houston. Washington has four games against teams that are predicted to rank between 28th and 32nd in the league. And they'll play the 30th, 31st, and 32nd ranked defenses, if this turns out to be true, in Chicago, Detroit, and Houston. So six games against the predicted top half of the league, 11 against the predicted back half of the league, and several games against teams ranked 23rd and lower. Two against Philly, all right? Two against the Giants, and then you get Jacksonville, Chicago, Detroit, and Houston. That's eight games against teams that are predicted to be 23rd or lower in the NFL next year. So offensively, and again, it might not work out that way, but offensively, it's not really what the defense was facing going in to 2021. All right, Scott Van Pelt next, right after these words from a few of our sponsors. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. Doesn't cost you a thing. Rate us and review us, especially on Apple and Spotify. It's a big help for us. Scott Van Pelt is at Southern Hills in Tulsa, Oklahoma, where he has been all week long getting ready for the PGA Championship this weekend at an iconic course. First of all, before we get to the course, which the players seem to like, for those who have never been to Tulsa, what's Tulsa like?
It's fascinating. I'm actually, as we speak, I'm on my drive-in, and it was this drive-in the other day that just my head was on a swivel, just trying to process it all. It's just it seems like it's kind of an eclectic mix of all sorts of things. There are lots of dispensaries if you need weed of any kind.
they're good. Plenty of those options.
Yeah, I don't know. We actually had a meal last night. Fantastic meal with a local. This is actually a great story. There's a guy on Twitter named Bunky Perkins who I follow, who's a very funny follow. And we met him out last night. He's a local resident. He set it up at this great restaurant. I'll give him a pop. It's called Smoke. If you're in Tulsa, go to Smoke. It's really good. And we were laughing about it going in because it's like, who knows who this person could be an insane person. I mean, we could wind up, you know, in a hotel in Broken Arrow with our organs harvested.
Broken Arrow, yeah.
Into here. Well, no. We met the real Bunky Perkins, who's a real-life person, who's a fantastic guy, great company. He set us up in this great back room at this place called Smoke. And, you know, he was giving us kind of a lay of the land of Tulsa. And the funny thing, Kevin, is years and years and years ago, I used to come out to Oklahoma because my grandpa was from a town in the northeast corner of the state called Miami. And so I'd been to Tulsa and then driven out. And I know some of the local things. I mentioned this spot where we used to go, and this guy was just laughing. He's like, you know Grand Lake? I'm like, yeah, we used to. My family, my great-granddad had a house out there and blah, 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 blah. Anyway, so I think I don't pretend to know a lot about it. We drive to the golf course, and then we go back to our hotel. But it's an incredible golf course. I think they're going to have a phenomenal week here.
So tell us about the golf course. The players seem to be raving about it.
It's fantastic. I walked the front nine on Monday with Brian Harmon. I walked the back nine yesterday with it was a fun group. It was Max Homa, a guy named Taylor Gooch, Xander Schauffele, Patrick Cantlay, and it's just visually, I think it's fun to look at because Gil Hance, who's the golf course architect, came in here in about 3 years ago and kind of redid some things. The creeks are more pronounced. The bunkers are more pronounced. So just what you're looking at visually, I think it presents itself well. And it's a big ballpark. It's a big golf course. They've taken off the rough from around the green, so that it's all runoff. And so it's almost in some ways reminiscent of, like, say, a Pinehurst in that way.
Right.
But the greens aren't Pinehurst, because Pinehurst greens, as people listening that are golf fans know, are like these upside-down saucers. So it almost repels a shot, even one that might be hit pretty well. It's not like that here. If you hit a good shot, you're going to stay on greens. But if you hit a poor shot and it's running, it's going to run through. So short game's going to be massively important here this week, because you're not going to hit all these greens because it's supposed to be windy. It's hot now, but it's going to be on the weekend like in the 60s, which is odd. By the way, I said it's going to be 97 at home on Sunday.
Yeah, 97.
On Saturday?
Yeah.
What are we doing?
Very hot.
That's no good at all. But it's big. You know, you always talk about score, and like with the wind, you don't know. No one's ever got to double digits here. This is the eighth major they've had. And I think somebody could, because I think someone, these guys are so good, Kevin, if somebody shot, you know, 64, you know, even 63. I mean, would I be shocked if someone did that? No, that's what these guys do. But if it gets windy and the greens do get a little bit faster, which they could because they dry out quick when the humidity's gone, then it'll be a massive battle.
Well, what do you think what is the projected winning score this week?
No clue. I mean, like I said, talking to Andy, I mean, this is all just sort of the kind of, like, for instance, I had a talk yesterday with a guy named Scott Verplank, who, of course, is a well-known name from, who's not on the tour now, but played for many, many years, lives about an hour away and has played here a bunch. In fact, I think in 2007 on the weekend, he might have been in the group with Tiger on Saturday. Verplank played well in 07, but he was, you know, we were having this conversation. I said, you think somebody could shoot this? And he said, well, sure. But he said, the wind's the great unknown. because when the wind blows and the temperature drops, because it's like 90 today, but when it gets to the 60s, as Scott said, the humidity goes away, the greens do get quickly, and then all of a sudden, anything under par becomes really hard to find. So I think whatever Tiger shot in 2007, I want to say it was 7 or 8, most of it was done in one round. He shot a 63 and had one round of that. So almost all the damage was done in one day. So I keep thinking somebody's going to shoot 10, but I could be completely wrong if the weather's not conducive to shooting something in the 60s.
That was his only round of 63 in a major, right?
That sounds right. That sounds right.
What are you?
63 forever is the lowest limit.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
What are you expecting from him this weekend? That's what a lot of people want to know.
I mean, anything I say is a guess, because the last time we saw him, he was shooting 78-78 at Augusta on the weekend, and did it with a smile, because, you know, I think it represented some significance. And we haven't seen him since then. And so I don't know how you can possibly know. My understanding is he's a little better physically. I mean, he's maybe a little stronger. But this walk's no treat either. It's not Augusta, but, I mean, there's some significant hills. I mean, it's called Southern Hills for a reason. It's after that first tee, I was joking the other day when I was walking with Brian Harmer, I said, I just want to lay down and roll down the hill. It seems like it'd be easier. It's like,
it's straight. Downhill.
It's like it's elevated tee, and you walk straight down a very steep hill off of one tee. But I mean, the thing, like for instance, the last time we saw Jordan Spieth, he played at Augusta, he missed the cut. Well, then he won at Harbortown. He finished second last week. In Texas. So you have some idea of where he is. Well, we haven't seen Tiger since the Masters. So what do I expect? When I say, well, I think he'll do this, I don't have a friggin' clue. So, I mean, I'm happy to say something if you want me to make it up. But
well, I don't want you to make it up.
Anyone could answer.
But how
can I answer that question when I have no idea? I haven't seen him, and I don't know.
Okay, I still think it was a decent question and one that people would want the answer to, even if the answer is you don't know.
No. I'm not faulting your question.
I know you're not.
I'm telling you.
But here's
telling you, I don't have an answer for your question. I have no answer.
Here's the thing that we know, don't we? I mean, he could injure himself again this weekend, and there could be a back injury or something. But it does appear, given that there was speculation that he might not play this, and now all of a sudden talk that he might play the Memorial, that Tiger, for what we, you know, Tiger's back to a certain degree, isn't he?
Well, he's back playing golf. I mean, like, the whole definition of back is that, I mean, has been all the, you know, it's been Tiger's back. What does that mean? He's back to being Tiger? Like, back to being the Tiger Woods that was the guy that won, like, 7 of 11 majors? No, he's not back, but he's back playing. That's all you can ask for. So, I mean, yes, I'm with you, because when he left Augusta, I thought, you know, maybe he doesn't play again until St. Andrews. But his competitive fire is such that he's not just going to sit around if he's able to do it at all. So I don't know. I mean, I was told that he was very, enthusiastic about, hey man, let's go. I mean, that I know, just in terms of being his appetite to get out there and compete is there. He's not here again. It's not ceremonial. It's not just because he's got nothing else to do. It's because he wants to try to compete. So I think that's optimistic. And I mean, the golf looked pretty good early at Augusta, and then I think the toll of the weekend, and you know, it was very cool, and the walk and all the rest of it. By Saturday, Sunday, I mean, he, you know, 78-78. I mean, I think that's the one time you'll ever see him shoot that and smile walking off a golf course. I don't think he's not here hoping to do that. I know that much, but I just haven't got a clue about what's reasonable to think or what his form is, because we just don't have anything to go off of.
Yeah, I wonder when we will, as golf fans, get to the point where it's not exciting, or we don't think deep down somewhere that he's actually got a chance since he's playing. Like, I hope it's still years from now. I hope we still have like a 3-4-5 year run of Tiger playing enough to think that he's got a chance, because I just think it makes the overall event just much bigger.
Totally agree with that, and I do think that what Phil did last year, winning at 51, I think, or he was about 51 because his birthday's in June. That Tiger's physical fitness, outside of all of these been throughs in terms of surgeries and all, gives you the hope that you'll get that. That was interesting. I was talking to one of the players about Tiger and like, what do you think in terms of how long? And I said, I don't know. I think his hunger to compete isn't ever going to wane. But it is a tricky kind of a deal for the game, because there's a ton of players who are exciting and guys that people like to watch. You know, Max Homa, who won in our neighborhood. Yeah. People really like Max. He's a fantastic guy and a likable guy and a guy worth rooting for. And there's so many different types of players like that in the game. But they would be the first to say, none of us are that guy. None of us captivate people's imagination and attention like Tiger. I mean, look, there's a reason why our ratings were what they were for the Masters, and CBS's ratings for what they were. It's because he's in the mix. Everyone knows that.
So let's talk about Phil for a moment, because I think a lot of people start paying attention for the majors. And I know this question was asked prior to the Masters, but, you know, he had a chance to play this weekend and defend his PGA championship. In the simplest of terms, for people who haven't been paying attention, why isn't Phil Mickelson playing golf right now?
Well, I can only guess. I mean, he was linked to this Saudi-backed tour. He made comments to an author named Alan Shipnuck, who wrote a biography, unauthorized biography, which I guess came out this week, where he made the comments about the Saudis, and they were pretty, you know, inflammatory. And then he ended up releasing this lengthy statement apologizing pretty much everybody other than, I guess, the PGA Tour for what he had to say. And then he basically put himself in exile, saying he was stepping away. And he hasn't come back. And so why is he not here this week? Well, I don't know. And is it because he didn't want to have to, as a defending champion, just as Phil Mickelson, he would have had a press conference. Well, had he had a press conference, Kevin, then it would have been packed, and people would have said, what exactly did you mean by all the different things that you said? And then he'd have had to answer them. Putting out a statement is you control the narrative, and you avoid being asked any pointed questions. And my sense is that his appetite to be asked questions about what he had to say is nil, or he'd already done it. And so it creates this fascinating dual storylines, where a year ago at Kiowa, he's the oldest major winner ever, and it was, you know, he's always been a beloved player. And when we left Kiowa, Kevin, had you told me that a year later Tiger Woods, who'd just been in this horrific accident, would play at Southern Hills and that Phil wouldn't, I wouldn't have believed either. But both are true. And so at some point Phil will resurface. And I don't know when it will be. Is it going to be at one of these Saudi events where he's going to play? Because at some point, somebody's going to ask him questions about what his story is and what he's doing. But he hasn't answered any questions yet. All he's done is put out a statement.
They're going to ask him about the $40 million in gambling losses during a 5-year period,
among other things.
Among other things. It's weird to me, this situation right now. And this is obviously from afar, but I'll try to explain it as best I can. Phil's always struck me as a guy that, you know, has all the answers and is rarely wrong in his own mind. And this just seems to me like, people are getting, you know, essentially forced into exile for just a lot worse than what he said or what he was contemplating with respect to the Saudi tour or any of the other stuff that's in this book. And I guess My feeling is it's like really weird that he hasn't just stepped up and faced the music and explained it away the way he believes he can explain it away. You know, where he gets very philosophical in sort of his answers and explains as a guy that, you know, kind of comes off as a guy that thinks he's smarter than everybody in the room. And yet, what is true right now is what you said. He's in exile.
But and right, so here's what I don't know. Is that self-imposed? Did the tour ask him to sit down for some period of time and suspend him? If so, for what? Like, over what would he have been suspended? It seems like that's the thing, is that there's these questions you don't know. I mean, it seems like he stepped away. I mean, he said he was stepping away to work on, I don't know the exact wording, something about to try to be a better this, that, and the other thing. And okay, and look, somebody's playing on this tour, and I mean, Lee Westwood was asked some questions about it, and he explained how there are a bunch of different sports that compete there, and golf certainly has through the years, and you know, there will be players who turn up to play at this event, at these events, I should say. I think, you know, the way Phil described them, and you know, talking about the Saudis in general.
Right.
I mean, everyone knows the comments he made to Shipbook. I don't know that those on their own would have, they wouldn't have prevented him from being a defending champion here. But it would have required him sitting down and being asked questions about it. And he didn't want to do it. He didn't say, I'm not playing. He told the PGA on Friday afternoon late, and the PGA of America put the statement out. Right. So it's just, I don't know, it creates a very, it gets curiouser and curiouser, right? I mean, the longer that he says nothing publicly on the, you know, on the record, then the more you just are left to wonder, what are we doing here?
Maybe Bunky Perkins has the answer to all of that.
I don't know. Bunky knows where to get a good meal in Tulsa. I know that much.
Yes, smoke. All right, real quickly, who do you like and why? And then give me like a sleeper that people aren't thinking about that you think's got a really good chance.
Well, I think the conversation has to start with Scottie Scheffler for the very simple fact that he's the number one player in the world. The last major was the Masters. He showed up ranked number one and won. And he won when the Big 12 played here back when he was in college. He played an event here, won. He's called this his favorite golf course in the world. I mean, he's that guy, right? I mean, you show up number one at the Masters and win. I mean, that's only ever happened once before. It was Ian Woosnam many years ago. And it's a course where you have history and you say it's your favorite. I mean, sometimes I've said this a lot about this, question when I've been asked. Sometimes, Kevin, I think we work really hard to try to be clever and figure out like a sneaky answer. Sometimes you just say what's obvious, like that. Scottie Scheffler. You start with him. But as I've walked it the last couple of days, and I'm getting ready to head out and take another stroll, I mean, the fairways are massive. If good drivers of the golf ball are gonna play well, good ball strikers are going to play well, and short game is really important. I really like Spieth. Since the Masters, he won at Harbortown, and he finished second last week, and his short game is as clever as any in the world. He can really rely on that, and it would be a tremendous storyline. No one's ever finished the slam with the PGA, which is what Spieth now is going to spend the rest of his career trying to do. It wouldn't shock me at all if he were to play well and win. Ball hitters, like guys that really are known for ball striking, a Morikawa I would expect to play well here. I think Xander Schauffele is a guy who, off last week where he shot 61, very different kind of golf course, but he played great on Sunday. And he's the kind of player I think at some point has to just bust through in a major. A name that probably you're not going to hear said necessarily, but is a really well-regarded player and has some of the things you want to lean into this week, maybe a Daniel Berger. I think Berger's the guy that could play well on this golf course, so I wouldn't call him a sleeper per se. I just don't think you'd hear that name necessarily mentioned on our air or even the Golf Channel beforehand, but if you're in one of those pools and you're picking a guy from this column and that column and the other column, I don't know. I think he's a name that might be a decent name to lean into. I like Harmon too. Now, granted, I just want to be honest. I told Steve this on our podcast. Kevin, whoever I walk with, I see him hit it, and I go, "Wow, Brian Harmon's good.
Yeah.
He could play well here." But he drives it great and has played well in majors. He's one of those sneaky guys that you don't think about him, first or last.
He's a little guy, isn't he?
He's not a big guy. He's we were laughing about, about my height and his height, and we made a good combo. But he's just an awesome dude. Huge sports fan. We had a great walk just talking about sports, and you watch this guy kind of, absent-mindedly. Like, he's doing his work, but we're engaged in conversation the whole time, and I'm trying to make sure I'm not bothering him, right? But you're just watching him, not really grinding seemingly, but just effortlessly hitting fairways and greens and rolling in putts, and you just think, Jesus Christ, these people play a game that is just so astounding, man. And when you see it up close, it just makes you realize that you and your buddies and me and my buddies, I mean, we like to play, but oh my gosh, we don't do anything resembling any of what they do.
So back to Scheffler. So is that our new thing? We're going with the obvious now?
No, I'm just saying that, like...
No, I think with the obvious now is the contrarian move. I think so many people now are on to this, it's too obvious, can't go there. Maybe that's the new contrarianism, is to go with the obvious.
I don't know if it's the contrarian. I think that we all, and by we, I mean people like you and me, Kevin, who spend our time in the content of sports and how presenting it however we do, I think we can sometimes try too hard to figure out something to make us seem smart. And in this case, I'm just saying it isn't necessary. you can point to the guy who's number one, who won the last Masters, who says this is his favorite course, and go, him. Let's start with him. And, okay, we got him? Okay, good. Now you want to now? I mean, look, John Rahm's just as obvious. Could he win? Of course. I think I picked him for ESPN.com. I mean, I get asked so many times. By the end of the week, I've told
you've got
somebody
everybody.
The winner somewhere. You know what I mean? So I just think Scheffler maybe isn't the most. You're supposed to have some kind of insight that's beyond the obvious, right? And I don't know that I do here. He's the guy. I mean, he's it's amazing how quickly he became that. He's earned that. Those kind of bona fides.
Have you gotten over the caps or not?
Sure. I mean, you can make fun of me, and you do.
I'm not making fun of you. I know how upset you were last Friday night. I'm asking a simple question.
I think the Stanley Cup playoffs are fascinating, because the difference between winning and losing is incredibly minuscule. I mean, look at Sunday in the NBA, and look at Sunday in
the overtimes, the playoffs, and the blowouts.
There were two NBA games, blowouts both. Two Stanley Cup playoff games, overtime both. Look at the Caps. They're up 2-1. They're up 2-1 in game four. They hit a post with an empty net. If they make that, they're ahead 3-1 in the series. Instead, they don't. The Panthers tie it, and they lose in overtime. The Caps are up 3-0 in Game 5. The Panthers, who had the most comebacks in the NHL, come back and win that. The Caps have the lead in Game 6. Overtime, they lose that. I mean, the difference between the one seed beating the Caps and the Caps being the team that moved on was fractional. And I just think that would be an incredibly painful existence. And it's not exclusive to the Caps. Look at the Toronto Maple Leafs. They haven't won a playoff series in almost 20 years. And they have a great team, and they couldn't beat the Lightning, because you can't beat the Lightning. You have to kill them 26 times for them to die. I really love them. I can't skate. I've never played hockey in my whole life, but I find the Stanley Cup playoffs to be the most compelling theater in playoff sports.
I think it's true. You know that I love watching these Stanley Cup playoffs, these, you know, these overtime games, these seventh and deciding games. I think one of the real ironies of the conversation about hockey, especially with people like the two of us, where we'll say there's this incredible fine line and, you know, and they've had all these game seven losses, the Caps. And if not for those, maybe Ovechkin's got three Stanley Cup appearances and one Stanley Cup title. And it's random and this and that. And I think there's a certain truth to that. And at the same time, it's hard to find a sport with more dynasties than the NHL. You know, long runs of Stanley Cup winners.
Yeah, that's interesting. And I mean, that's what makes this Tampa Bay team incredible to me. And we've had their Coach Cooper, on a number of occasions. He's got a really interesting story, how he got where he is. And the first year they won, I had written down Virginia. I was going to ask him about Virginia because they had been the number one seed, and they lost. And just like that, Tampa Bay had been the one seed the year before they won their first cup, and they got swept by the eighth seed. It was the Blue Jackets. And as he was getting ready to come on, I saw he had a Virginia hat. And I said, "Is that a Virginia hat?" And he said, "Oh, yeah." And I said, "That's incredible." And that's where we started, but about how he kind of embraced that notion with his guys that, look, you can have expectation and something goes wrong, but you come back from it and you win a title the way Virginia did.
The UMBC thing, for people who aren't following, when they lost to UMBC as a 1 versus a 16.
Right, Virginia, yes, that's what I'm trying to say. The Virginia basketball team lost as a 1 seed. Then they came back the next year as a 1, and they won a title. And so Cooper had kind of embraced that idea with his team. And since then, they've won 2 Stanley Cups in a row, and they were down to Toronto, a team that was expected to finally win a series, and they went up in Toronto and won a Game 7. And it is interesting that there are 2 in a row in this era is dynastic. You know, we haven't seen a team win 3 in a row in any sport since the Lakers in the early 2000s. So that is fascinating that a sport where the margins are so narrow, it seems to be so hard.
Well, I mean, you know, I did this
more common than other sports.
Yeah, I did this a few weeks ago. It's like if you start with like Montreal and in the 70s, then the Islanders 70s into the 80s, then Edmonton and Gretzky, and then Lemieux and Pittsburgh, and then Detroit, and then, you know, you had, you know, the Penguins and the Blackhawks, and now you've got the Lightning with 2 in a row. It's just, you know, you obviously had the Blues and the Caps who had never won it. Well, maybe the Blues had won it many, many years ago, but it had been forever. But it's a sport where everybody talks about, me included, knowing nothing about the sport, how, you know, pucks bounce off a pad and off a post and go either in or out, and that's the difference. And yet there have been so many dominant teams in the history of the sport.
But true, but I do think what makes it such incredible theater is to go back and retrace the steps and see how close it was to being, you know,
yeah, a loss.
The other outcome. I mean, look, the Colorado Avalanche played Nashville in the first round and they swept them. And they were up 5-0 in the first game in the first 15 minutes, and they, you know, they swept and it was easy. And they happened to win an overtime game last night against the Blues. But mostly it's series like the Caps and the Panthers.
Yeah.
Where it could be anything. I mean, it could have been the other team could have won, and had the Capitals won, nothing about that outcome would have felt inappropriate. Nothing about it would have felt like, well, they shouldn't have been the team that won. It was very close to being just that. And I guess that's what makes me so compelled by a sport that I have absolutely no understanding of how I couldn't do any of what they do. And I do enjoy it. And I was bummed for them. I like this team. They're an older team. You know, you're only going to get so many more of these with that kind of core group of guys that were part of that cup winning team. And maybe that's the problem. I mean, you know, the chatter from other people is, you're old, you got all your money sunk into older people, blah, blah, blah. I don't know.
Yeah, people have explained it to me.
I enjoy watching them play.
Yeah, it's funny about that because people have explained to me over the last week the irony is that, you know, the window was closing when they won it in 2018, you know, according to a lot of the hockey people. And then they won it, and then it was, well, you know, if they're going to take advantage of it, Ovechkin's got to keep up the pace. And he has. You know, he has not fallen off, and yet they've gone out in the first round four straight years now. And that,
right, but I mean, yeah. Again, look at how they've lost. I mean, yeah. How they lost to Carolina, how they lost this, and you know, you lose Tom Wilson in the middle of that first game. Is it a different series if you have him? Is it a different series if Ovechkin's completely right? I mean, who knows? It doesn't. I guess in the end, it doesn't matter because it's, you know, it's over and it's over. So I mean, but. This is a very long answer to it. I was bummed for them. I really enjoyed. We went down to that game. I look forward to going to more in the future. My kids had a blast, and I explained on the I explained on my podcast. And my little guy's like, "Who's over chicken?" when Charlie saw the jersey,
Charlie said, "Over chicken."
Yeah, he goes, "Who's over chicken?"
Yeah,
and then Sam got mad. He goes, "He's your best player, Charlie." And so in our house. Number 8 is over chicken.
Well, I'll tell you this. I think I've told you this before. You know how much my boys loved going to games, Maryland basketball games in particular. But for a truly young person, and by the way, I think this goes for any age, I think hockey is the best sport live. Like, I think it's much better, or the disparity between live and television is the greatest with hockey. It is so great live. It's good on television, and we just talked about how we're both, you know, into the NHL playoffs, especially, you know, I think somebody should build an app that indicates, you know, that basically tells you when a game is going into overtime in the NHL playoffs and what network it's on and where to turn to right away, because there's nothing more dramatic in terms of the ending than a hockey overtime playoff game. But it's a great product live. Really good product live.
Truly, and I think I haven't been to a ton of Capitals games, but I always leave there thinking it's a great building. There's great energy. They do a tremendous job with just the lighting and the atmosphere and the mood that's created, yep. Right, with the production. I think, I mean, I don't know that it's unique to them. I just know that they do it really well in terms of what it looks like and what it sounds like, and it's, you know, it's the kids are just, wow, it's so loud. I said, well, it's loud because they scored 6 goals. I mean, it's not always, you don't always have this many eruptions. But it is, it's breathtaking, the speed of it, and to see it, to see plays executed live. I mean, it's not unlike walking right next to these players in the fairway and seeing things and realizing what they're capable of. And when you sit down there close and you see these athletes on the ice doing what they're doing, you just shake your head and amazement, because it's incredible that sport up close. It's just breathtaking.
All right, I know you have to go, but I would just thought of something because I was just looking at TV and Patrick Beverley's.
So
been
you
on...
don't care that I have to go and are going to ask me something else?
Yeah, exactly. Patrick Beverley's been on your network all week long, and he's made headlines all week long. And I remember, and it was just recently, for whatever reason, in a conversation we were having, Pat Beverley's name came up, and you said about him as an interview, what?
That I found him to be one of the most interesting people that I've ever talked to in all of my time, because he's interesting, and he asks questions about you because he's interested in you, and he's sincere about that. At least that's the conversations that he and I have had, and I mean, his story of how he came up and how he kind of had to go overseas and really create a lane for himself, which he has, I've always appreciated. And these last couple of days, he's just gone on TV with a flamethrower, I guess.
It's incredible what he said about Chris Paul, called him the cone. But, you know, it's so interesting about guys like him. First of all, he's one of these crazy competitive dudes. I've always loved watching him. But I think guys that have played overseas for a long period of time before they make it, there's a more well-roundedness to them than just the guy that goes straight to the NBA, especially like out of high school or from the G League. I think you get that from...
I also think there's an appreciation that's different. If all you've ever known is being a 5-star who went to a high-level program who was a lottery pick, well, then this was always ordained from the start. And I don't fault that player for not having perspective, because if all you've ever known is, you know, high thread count sheets and filet, you know, you sleep comfortably and you eat well, all right? If you've not known that, and you've had to go play abroad, and you've had to create some kind of a path for yourself, and are doubted and are traded and whatever else, then I definitely think that the chip that you put on your shoulder that becomes, I mean, in his case, it's a boulder. My God, he's like Santa Claus with a bag full of rocks he's carrying around. That's real. It's not manufactured. Now, I've been out here working, so I've seen is sort of the chatter on Twitter or whatever. I mean, I say this saying I like Patrick Beverley because I do. At some point, I don't know that we need days and days of him going on TV and just saying everyone sucks. I don't know if that's what he's been doing.
Well, he hasn't been doing that. But
No, it just seems like he's got a bone to pick with Chris Paul.
Right. And others, but he's been highly complimentary of others as well. All right. Enjoy this weekend. I will talk to you soon. Thank you for doing this.
It's my pleasure as always. Be well.
All right. We are done for the day. I'll be back tomorrow with Tommy.